Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Tom, co-publisher of Healthy Referral Newspaper here in Cleveland, Ohio, substituting for Marcia today. She's on the road on the way here. Today we have an amazing show. Before we get to that, Healthy Referral has been publishing information about preventive natural health since 89, and we've come across some amazing people over that time to bring you some cutting, leading-edge information about preventive natural health, holistic ideas, natural foods. The new word is sometimes called integrative medicine. Our website is healthyreferral.com. Today's our first guest is Dr. Stephen Holt, who's an international speaker, speaks at many world anti-aging conferences around the world, professor of medicine, founder of Holt Health Institute, or the Holt Institute of Medicine, I should say. Has written two amazing new books on anti-aging, as well as the HCG Diet Revolution, and we'll say hello to Dr. Holt. Are you on the line, Dr. Holt? Okay, let me see what we got here. Are you there, Dr. Holt?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much for the time this afternoon. And before we start, I did a short little introduction about yourself, but can you just embellish upon that for just a few minutes for the listeners that might not be familiar with your work?
Well, yes, thank you very much. I practiced medicine for 40 years, and basically my subspecialty training has been in gastroenterology, nutrition, and of course the basis was in internal medicine. I've written about 24, 25 books over the years, many, many articles, and my career in the United States started in Cleveland, of all places. I was an associate professor at Case Western Reserve University and, you know, moved on subsequently and live currently in the New York area. And my interests really are in therapeutics. That's really a fancy word for treatment. So in essence, I qualify for the title old man, been around a long time and still learning. So
yeah,
it's a pleasure to be a guest on your show. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I know one of your, you just recently wrote a book on the anti-aging, you called it the anti-aging triad, and I thought that was an interesting topic. Could you please just give a brief synopsis on what are some of your discoveries in the anti-aging triad and how that could, you know, help the listener navigate the today's state of health is not what it used to be with the more disease popping up than ever before.
Well, I understand the notion of young forever is planted in everyone's mind. Being a sort of a child of the 60s, the baby boomer generation, I belong to the crowd that doesn't want to grow old. To be lighthearted, you know, there's been a lot of proposals, and even in folklore medicine, you know, we've talked about trying to find, the holy grail of health and longevity, and, of course, this has become a very topical area. As we all want to retain our youth and vitality. And in essence, the anti-aging triad comes out of many years of interest that I've had in biomedical sciences that really are serious aspects of aging, because a lot of anti-aging interventions are really gimmicks. You know, they're short-term things that don't work. Let's face it, changing the physical appearance of somebody's face is really, at best, the longest-term measure we've got available. But, you know, that's really a Band-Aid approach, because what we're looking at it is trying to turn back the clock on, you know, our overall aging, which is, you know, more to do with what's in within the body rather than what's obvious for us to see. So against that background, we have a lot of premature early death, which, you know, is related to lifestyle. And the term triad came out of the identification of three areas that I felt were extremely important in modern medicine, contemporary medicine, in the field of anti-aging, and very serious areas. The first is controlling your calorie intake. In essence, calorie restriction is the only intervention that's been shown to increase lifespan. I stress, the only intervention shown to be effective. The second area that we focused on very recently, which was the focus of the awarding of a Nobel Prize to U.S. researchers primarily, was looking at the ends or tips of chromosomes that we call telomeres and how they can be lengthened or maintain their length. So that's the second component of the triad. And of course, the word triad implies three. And the third component is the jazz of modern medicine when we're talking about stem cells and what we can do with replacing body parts, regrowing tissues, regenerative medicine. And those are the three areas that are in my book, The Anti-Aging Triad, with an overview of the science of these areas for, you know, general readership.
Yeah, when you say calorie restriction, can you expand upon, you know, what exactly that you mean by calorie restriction? Because I know some people, when they think of going on a diet, they restrict their calories, but there's a balance between what they have and the restriction of how much they have. Can you expand upon what your meaning of calorie restriction is?
Right, Tom. I apologize for the length of my responses, but this has to be carefully explained, and that was a great question. The science of calorie restriction is looking at the institution of a diet, essentially, in which the total calorie intake, that's the, if you like, the fuel we're taking in, is of the order of something like 1,200 calories a day or less. Now, most of us are out there, you know, in average circumstances, consuming anything up to 4,000 calories a day, and we have the most obese nation in the world with the biggest problem with premature death from an overweight status. Now, being overweight is certainly correlated with reduced lifespan. So there have been studies, initially in animals, and then more recently in humans, in very well-conducted projects, that show that restriction of calories of that order reduce a lot of age-related disease, like cardiovascular disease is reduced. We see improvements in cognitive function. We see evidence that tips towards a lower prevalence of cancer development. We see a number of benefits that all add up to improving, let's say, our measures of what is an anti-aging profile. So it's calorie restriction that it's all about. Now, there's a clever twist come into it. And the power of calorie restriction was shown 70 years ago, originally in mice. But the new twist that's come in these days is to talk about calorie restriction mimetics. Now, mimetic means mimic. So the question is, how can we mimic calorie restriction with all of its beneficial effects without actually getting into calorie restriction? Because going on a protracted diet is a very hard thing for most people, many people. So calorie restriction mimetics are compounds that duplicate or mimic the effects of calorie restriction. And, you know, one classic example of this are certain anti-aging principles that we're finding in, you know, our diet that, you know, may be important. Like, for example, certain antioxidant compounds that are available in our diet mimic some of the beneficial effects of calorie restriction without the act of restricting calories. Now, in my book, I say, look, this isn't an easy way out. It's not just changing your diet and eating, you know, as much as you like. It's more to do with a combination of moderation of calorie intake together with the possibility of taking these calorie restriction mimetic compounds. And they are natural, a lot of these compounds, and occur, you know, in nature. Good example are the factors that we find, antioxidants that we find in grapes, for example, has calorie restriction mimetic activity. And there's one example of a calorie restriction mimetic, and people have put these mimetics together in supplements that are used with modest calorie restriction with the intention of improving lifespan. And this is predicted to be beneficial, but of course we haven't got long-term studies showing enhanced lifespan with, you know, taking calorie restriction mimetics. So I hope I'm explaining this without being too complex. That is, calorie restriction itself is a good thing. We shouldn't overeat. We shouldn't overdo our calorie intake. But taking compounds that mimic the beneficial effects of calorie restriction, which are available such as antioxidants, can themselves help expand lifespan. And there's a lot of science behind this.
Yeah. What would you say about populations then that are living to, at least you hear they are, 110, 120, and the Hunza people up in the Himalayas or in Peru, certain populations that are, what's your comment on that as far as, is that one of the few populations that's actually following what you're saying about calorie restriction then?
There is a tendency in some of those people who are blessed with longevity to have a reduction in calorie intake. I mean, you mentioned one, which was the Hunzas of Pakistan. And the Hunzas from the mountain region, the thing that's ascribed in their diet to benefit of longevity is enhanced mineral intake, because they drink milky water enhanced with minerals in their environment. And, you know, that's an evidence taken indirectly that mineral intake is helping improve longevity. When you get to Okinawa in Japan, there are, again, theories about mineral enrichment of their diet, and this is where a lot of these theories of coral calcium came in, but those theories have been a little overplayed, a little over-exaggerated, especially by people like Robert Barefoot, who came out with bizarre conclusions, you know, about the benefits of coral calcium, which in itself is a very beneficial supplement, but not a panacea. And when I was talking about antioxidants, I'll mention a key one that's a calorie restriction mimetic. It's resveratrol, a lot of interest in resveratrol. And it's a key multifunctional antioxidant that is really the archetypical or classic calorie restriction mimetic. So again, the population studies that you mentioned and others relate longevity to various aspects of the diet, but calorie restriction is seen as beneficial in improving longevity, because on average, for example, Japanese people, apart from those just in Okinawa in the south of Japan, do live longer.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they have a calorie intake that's lower than ours. And as I mentioned, there's a direct correlation relationship between being overweight, obese, uh-huh, and premature death.
Yeah. What would you say then is the main thing that triggers somebody to eat more than they should?
Well, I don't think it's a simple issue. I mean, I was watching my friend Dr. Oz on TV today and listening actually in part to Andrew Weil and earlier Deepak Chopra talking a little bit about longevity. There are many, many factors involved. I mean, one big issue out there is stress. We believe stress-related illness, you know, shortens lifespan. I mentioned nutrition. Not only malnutrition, that's poor nutrition or undernutrition, but for us in North America, it's overnutrition that's killing us. And the emergence of things like metabolic syndrome, which simply speaking is pre-diabetes in many cases, but it's the variable combination of high blood pressure, cholesterol, being overweight, and insulin resistance as a forerunner to type 2 diabetes. And there's 70 million Americans with metabolic syndrome, most of whom are not treated.
Okay.
And they are basically the iceberg lying below the ocean in terms of the problem. What we see is the tip of the iceberg. You know, with diabetes, smoldering there is 70 million people with this life-threatening variable combination of those problems.
Yeah.
That's why cholesterol lowering is a huge issue. But to answer you, it's not just lowering cholesterol. It's not just losing weight. It's a much more holistic approach that works in anti-aging when it comes to nutrition.
So when you say the word metabolic, yeah, I've heard of that word before about somebody speeds up their metabolism. If their muscles are toned, they burn more calories at rest, for example. In the context that you're talking about, just give a quick definition for the listener on what you mean by the word metabolic.
Yeah, well, let's understand that metabolic syndrome is now a disease well classified in medicine, not formally really recognized until, you know, relatively recently. You know, in the past 5 years, it's been a disease classification. Metabolism is a word that really goes across all kinds of boundaries of the function of life. I mean, our cells are involved in complex chemical processes that are really metabolic pathways. So there you go. It's the chemistry of life. And
okay.
In essence, when I say metabolic syndrome, I'm referring to something that has also received the popular label Syndrome X.
Okay.
Syndrome X that people hear about is metabolic syndrome, sometimes called metabolic syndrome X, about which I have written extensively.
Okay. Move on a little bit to your second book called HCG Diet. Revolution. Expand upon basically what do the letters HCG mean, and why is that a diet revolution?
Well, in the last 24 months, there's become enormous interest, especially in more alternative medicine areas, in the use of HCG injection, which is, you know, human chorionic gonadotropin, which is a hormone that is secreted primarily in pregnancy. And many years ago, Dr. Simeons published in The Lancet, actually in the 50s, the use of HCG injections together with very profound calorie restriction for accelerated short-term weight loss. And HCG is combined with diet in 4 or 8 week cycles, and is a very profound way of rapidly inducing weight control. But my book goes into the science of it. It's a controversial area, but it's become extremely popular. And people have started to use homeopathic versions of HCG, for which there's no real evidence of benefit. And then, of course, you know, unfortunately, we always have a segment that capitalizes on something new that's trendy and over-promotes
right.
it. But my book is a serious analysis of the world literature to support the use of the HCG diet, which, you know, millions of people globally have tried now with, you know, in some cases, outstanding success. I mean, I've seen people lose very, very large amounts of weight on HCG diets. And the argument is it just the calorie restriction because it's a very mean calorie diet, or is it the HCG that adds the metabolic benefit? And I think HCG has scientifically a basis to improve metabolism towards weight control. But, you know, it's a controversial area, and this book is quite popular because people are out there taking this HCG diet. And my books, The Anti-Aging Triad, people can see a review at theantiagingtriad.com and the HCG Diet Revolution. .com, and both books are carried by AuthorHouse.com.
Okay.
AuthorHouse.com.
Okay. When you say that somebody is losing weight, is it a combination of like protein, fat, carbohydrate, or is it a balance? Is it a safer way or more balanced way to lose the fat, or is it a combination of different? You know, is muscle tissue being lost, or
it's a fairly complex diet for me to describe simplistically, but it is a total reduction of calorie intake to certainly of the order of a few hundred calories a day. So it's a real drastic calorie reduction together with HCG injections on a daily basis. So it's a fairly intrusive diet, and you know, the question is it safe? The argument is not only is it safe, is it really effective, or is it just all about drastically reducing calorie intake down to 600, 800, below 800 calories a day, which will cause accelerated weight loss in, you know, anybody more or less who does that. If there isn't weight loss of that kind of severe calorie reduction in the diet, something's very wrong, because the energy equation of the body needs about 1,200 calories a day on average for an adult to just tick over without much exercise. So at 800 and below, you're actually in negative calorie balance and will inevitably lose weight. The argument is, what does HCG do on top of that that's advantageous? And that's where there's an argument between integrative medical practitioners and more conventional practitioners who say HCG is a waste of time. And early studies, in fact, performed in a very poor way by conventional physicians, led to conclusions that HCG wasn't effective, but what wasn't good was the studies were performed in a way that couldn't draw effective conclusions. And sometimes you see that in medicine, where people get cocky and confident about the outcome of a treatment, and the studies that demonstrated the outcome were not ideal or definitive in proving what was being tested. So I don't want to get too complex, but it's
sure.
a big area for a lot of people.
Right. Oh, we have a few minutes left here. What we could do is comment on what you see as the most pressing health challenge of today's society, and just your general comments on what people can just in their average daily life, what they can do about it.
Whoa, talk about Pandora's box. with brevity, I'll answer. Well, we have huge problems. The number one cause still of death is cardiovascular disease, but, you know, cancer's creeping up. Obviously, factors that cause cardiovascular disease are very important, like the weight status of the nation. So there's those issues that all come in. There's a tendency now for people to live longer. We kicked off with anti-aging medicine. But there are many factors, and the solution in modern medicine is not going to be a high-tech intervention. You know, it's not going to be a magical bionic man or anything. The future in medicine is going to be improvement in lifestyle, defined right. as clean living. There you go. And I'm not being pious, but, you know, things like that are obvious. Don't drink excessively. Don't smoke. Maintain healthy body weight. Maintain good psychological well-being without stress. Get a good balanced diet. That's what's going to make the difference in terms of promotion of health in general, not the next magical cure or the next, gimmick that comes across the TV screen where, you know, you could grow a new brain or some other absurd statement that may be made on one or more of these outrageous infomercials that keep coming up on TV, which really are examples in some respects of consumer fraud. So again, I'm not being pious. It's just that the solution to health and well-being is really about the way we live. And, you know, it's what, you know, our grandmothers and mothers.
Right. You mentioned cardiovascular. Maybe you could just touch on a little bit. I know there's a lot of confusion out there with different research showing that it's, you know, you watch your cholesterol and then it was cholesterol is not the issue. There's other factors that go into it as far as the plaque development.
Of course, it's multifactorial, as I said. Don't just, you know, consider the cholesterol level alone. I mean, if you smoke and you have diabetes and you don't have physical exercise, they all add up, you know, 2 + 2 + 2 and compound the risk. And in these circumstances, it's often 2 + 2 = 5, not 4, because they compound each other. So, yes, you're right. It's a multifactorial aspect. But I'll give a strong message. Anybody who doesn't think cholesterol excess is an underlying cause, one important factor in heart disease, should, in my opinion, join the Flat Earth Society. Okay? It's absolutely bunkum that, you know, people come up with these outrageous theories that have no basis in science. High blood cholesterol requires management.
Yeah, I understand. We could talk all day here, but there has been some things in the news lately about the word inflammation and how that is an indication of potential danger down the road. When you hear the word in different articles and different presentations,
right.
the word inflammation, what exactly do they mean by inflammation and what you can do about it?
Well, we now have theories that evoke inflammatory response in the body, which is the body's immune response, you know, that we see typically or most commonly in an infectious circumstance where there's chronic smoldering, increase in white cells, antibodies, and inflammation, which is rawness, redness, swelling, you know, that's inflammation. Now, simplistically speaking, we see inflammation now related to cardiovascular disease. It's certainly a very important component of diabetes, which we haven't really spoken about. And inflammatory disorders underlie, you know, a lot of diseases that tend to hang out together. So inflammation has become a big issue. Controlling the inflammatory process is believed to be important in preventing a number of chronic diseases, most specifically cardiovascular disease, where inflammation plays a major role. But again, it's one of several factors. You know, if you add inflammation to diabetes, to smoking, to inactivity, you know, you get a ticking time bomb. You know, you add all of these factors together, they all work in aggregate. And I said 2 + 2 = 5. Sometimes 2
right.
and 2 makes 7. They compound each other. So I hope I've answered this question adequately. Inflammation is a big deal. And we're looking at treatments now that are aimed at just controlling, preventive medical control of chronic smoldering inflammation. which can be related to a chronic infection. I mean, chronic inflammation is the cause, really, of simple peptic ulceration of the duodenum and stomach, which we don't see as commonly as we used to, but that's all about inflammation that's precipitated by a bug that grows in the lining of the stomach. The bug is called Helicobacter pylori, or Campylobacter species, but Helicobacter specifically pylori. And that's an example of chronic inflammation going to lead to an inflammatory structural disorder, in this case a peptic ulcer. So that's one example of how obvious inflammation, and that's what revolutionized the treatment of peptic ulcer disease when we started to use antibiotics to treat peptic ulcers to rid the body of that organism, which is sensitive to certain antibiotic combinations. So I hope that helps people understand. It's all about synergy. It's all about things added together, and it's about approaching life with balance. And these are not really clever, I'm not telling you anything that wasn't really forgotten by Victorian physicians 100 years ago, recognized, the notion of clean living, for want of better terminology. You know, you play with bad things, you'll get bad consequences. We've challenges in modern medicine. I mean, an example of a terrible chronic inflammatory process that emerges in the body with HIV disease, AIDS, is a gross example of an inflammatory disease with structural consequences, including, you know, the development of cancer. In that situation, Kaposi's sarcoma or skin cancer.
Yeah.
So, again, let me just say, it's like things hang out together, you know?
Bad guys
hang out together on the street corner. Diseases do the same thing.
Well, we really appreciate this incredible information, and we can go longer. Can you please also, if somebody wants to get more information or to go a little deeper on some of the things that you've talked about, can you give out a website or a...
I have a website that's easy, which is Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Holt, H-O-L-T, M-D.com. So that's Stephen spelled with a P-H, Holt, M-D.com. And my new portal newsletter is coming out next month on Wellness Times, which used to be called the Holt Health News, sponsored by Vitacost.com. Where I have a distribution of maybe as many as 2 million people that read this regular report I do on a weekly basis. And, of course, I work with you and your group with Healthy Referral, and I have, information posted on your website.
Yes.
You know, there's direction there for people to take a peek at what I'm doing. But, you know, I'm just maturing in a way that I realize as I get older, I know less and less, you know.
Well, we appreciate your bringing a lot of great things to light, and we'll have to look forward to another visit and delve into some of these great topics. So we'll talk to you very soon, Dr. Holt.
And thank you for the insightful questions, and I apologize if my answers were a little bit extended, but I wanted people to get it. There's a lot of concepts you asked me about that, you know, are not really easy lay concepts. But the language of anti-aging will be upon us within the next decade. Everybody will be talking about their telomeres. You know, they'll be measuring these chromosomal markers and, you know, relating them to age and longevity. You'll see it coming. It's down the pipe.
Yeah, okay. Well, we appreciate the insight. Thanks again, Dr. Holt.
And thank you very much for having me as a guest. Okay,
thank you again.
Bye.
And that was Dr. Holt. That was Dr. Stephen Holt from the Holt Health Institute.
Hello.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yes. We have...
Sorry, it's Stephen again. I must have called me back automatically. Anyway, good luck with the rest of the show.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Holt. Okay.
And hello.
We have thank you again for Dr. Holt, and we have two new
our next guest. Can you hear me okay? We have Bill. We have Bill Grant. Okay, are you there, Bill?
Yes,
okay, and we have Jerry Branham. Is Jerry you there?
Yes, hello, can you hear me?
Yes, okay, that's much better. Well, since we appreciate your time today, to have such wonderful, amazing guests with a tremendous background in health and nutrition. One is Bill Grant. He's from the New Jersey area, former Mr. America speaker, TV show host, personal trainer, among many, many other things. And another gentleman, his friend, Jerry Branham, who's out in California, has written over 3,000 articles and over 20 publications on nutrition, worked with consultant to the boxer Oscar De La Hoya. First, we'll start with just a general question that were basically just a quick introduction. Bill, can you just give a quick intro about yourself and your background, then we'll have Jerry go, and then I'll ask a question, then you both can comment on it. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay. All right, I've been training now for like 51 years. I started when I was 14 years old. I won the Mr. New Jersey, Mr. America, Mr. World. I've been an IFBB pro bodybuilder for many, many years. Matter of fact, Jerry Branham has written several articles about me during my bodybuilding career because he's a writer, and he was writing about bodybuilding, so I really appreciate what he was doing at that particular time. So, also, I'm a personal trainer. I work out of a place called Iron and Silk Fitness in New York. It's at 155 West East 3rd Street in New York City. It's a very high upscale personal training center. We have directors, movie stars, models, you name it. They come to this place to get themselves in great shape.
It's called Island like the
Iron and Silk Fitness. Like iron, like bodybuilding iron. It's a great name, Iron and Silk Fitness. I really like the name, and if you could see the logo, you'd really love the logo as well.
Okay, very good. And Jerry, go ahead and give it just a quick synopsis of your background.
Well, similarly to Bill, I started very young with weight training. I started actually when I was I first picked up a weight when I was about 11 years old, and by 12 years old, I was training regularly 3 times a week, and I come originally from Brooklyn, New York, and that's where I began my training. And the way my mind works is that I, even as a young boy, I always wanted to know the mechanics of something. I never took anything on face value. In other words, in those days, if somebody said to me, well, you have to eat more protein to get bigger muscles, a lot of young guys would just walk away and pile in the protein, not think about it. The way my mind worked is I wanted to know why. Why do muscles need more protein? So, you know, as a result of that, I started reading more and more about nutrition, educating myself. I remember the very first nutrition book I read at age 12 was a very famous book called Let's Eat Right to Keep Fit. It was written by Adele Davis, who was actually you might remember her. She was one of the top nutritionists of the early 60s. And I really, she wrote very well, and I got so excited reading about this stuff that I read more and more, and then I got into the scientific aspects. I went to college. I studied science with the intention of becoming an MD, which I unfortunately, I wasn't the greatest student, not grade-wise, but as far as attention goes. And I didn't actually try out to get into medical school. I just studied science. But most of what I've learned on nutrition and sports medicine and exercise physiology, it's all self-taught. It's what they call autodidactic. I basically taught myself over the course of, believe it or not, I guess it comes out to about 47 years of continuous study. And as part of my, as Bill pointed out, I'm a writer, and I write on sports, fitness, and nutrition, mainly sports nutrition. As part of my job, I actually read, believe it or not, I actually go through about as many as 100 medical journals a month. So I kind of keep up to date in all the latest research. In fact, some of the things I talk about, even a lot of MDs don't have any idea what I'm talking about because, you know, it's kind of like past what they learned in medical school. So that's basically what I do. And, so I'm pretty well known for my let's say, if you want to call it, expertise in sports nutrition. And as a result of that, I've worked with a lot of top athletes. As you mentioned, I worked for 3 years with Oscar De La Hoya. And during that period, he was undefeated. And the first fight he had after I stopped working for him, he lost. I'm not making a connection that it was because he wasn't working with me anymore. But I've worked with a number of boxers. I work with professional basketball players, hockey players. And basically what I do is I give them what they call a performance diet and supplementation program. And it's quite honestly, it's never failed to work. I'm batting 1,000 in all the athletes I've worked with. It's amazing what a good diet and a good supplementation, and Bill can confirm this, can do for an athlete. It's just absolutely incredible.
Yeah. Can you comment on or expand upon what you just mentioned about that performance diet, what that consists of, and then also, Bill, maybe you could also comment on how your diet has changed over the years from when you started till now.
Well,
okay, Jerry.
Okay, just briefly, without going into a lot of overly technical material, the performance diet depends on the sport. In other words, you have to look at the sport, and you have to determine the energy pathways that's going to be involved in the sport. Now, let's take boxing, since I work with a lot of boxers. With the boxing, you have a lot of explosiveness involved. You have a lot of anaerobic. It's a combination of mostly what they call anaerobic energy cycles with a little bit of aerobic there. So you concentrate on for example, nutrients and foods that are going to increase the endurance, prevent dehydration and actually increase muscle power and help recovery, and this works in tandem with the training of the boxer. And what I used to do is, since I worked with professional boxers, the fight used to go, I think if I remember correctly, it's 10 rounds or 12. It's been a while, so I can't remember. I think it's 10 rounds.
About 12 rounds now.
So what I used to do is I actually used to plan. I had a two-part job. I had to, since Oscar, for example, he was fighting as a welterweight most of the time I worked with him, so I had to get him to make the weight requirement. They had a weigh-in the day before the fight. I had to make sure that he maintained all of his lean mass all the way up to the weigh-in, and yet he weighed in at 147 pounds or slightly under to meet the requirements. But the key was that I wanted him to have 100% maximum energy with no loss of lean mass. This is a big mistake a lot of boxers make. In an effort to make weight, they lose a lot of lean mass and they wind up getting weak in the ring. Another thing was to maximize hydration. And after the weigh-in, interestingly enough, you might know this if you follow boxing, the boxers have like 24 hours to put weight back on. And I used to ask Oscar, well, how much do you want to weigh for the fight? I remember one particular fight, he was fighting at 147, but he wanted to, believe it or not, he wanted to weigh 162 on the day of the fight. And one day, I had to get him from 147 to 162 pounds, and I actually did that in one day, which I'm quite proud of. I actually amazed myself. I didn't think I'd be able to do it, but I actually did it. But, So the point is, hockey players, basketball players, each of them, requires a different type of nutritional diet or a balance of nutrients depending on their sport. So, again, I look at the sport, I look at the energy pathways involved, I look at the recovery requirements involved, and I plan the diet as such. And, depending on the individual, I'll throw in certain supplements. If they don't like certain foods, if they have problems with certain foods, I'll give certain supplements which would make up for the possible loss of nutrients by them not eating the food. So that's basically the way I work it out with the athletes.
Okay.
Go ahead, and Bill might want to add something.
Yeah, Bill, maybe you can comment on how your diet has changed over the years from when you started, till now, and then maybe we can go back to Jerry to have him give maybe some specifics to the listener who may be playing tennis or such, kind of a comparable sport to boxing. But go ahead and comment on your transition over the years, Bill.
Well, my diet was, as Jerry was talking about, you're talking about the sport thing, but I was thinking about the metabolizing type of thing as well. I had a very fast metabolism. In all honesty, in the beginning of my career for bodybuilding, I didn't really follow a great, great diet. My body could just metabolize anything. As the years went on, though, and meeting Jerry Branham, who I've known for many years, Jerry has been a real lifesaver. A lot of times Jerry has helped me when I was training for shows when I lived in L.A., to get ready. He would tell me things that I needed to eat. We were roommates at that time. And he really helped me a lot of how much protein I should take, how many carbs, when you're supposed to be eating, how many meals a day you're supposed to be eating. And, I can remember when I was in Sweden, Jerry. Remember when I lived in Sweden for 3 years? I was getting ready for the 1984 World Championship. And Toronto, Canada, and I was living in Stockholm at the time. that was probably one of the first times I really, really smoked a diet, man. I really just went crazy with the diet, and it really worked. I mean, it was a lot of things that Jerry had told me from before. I stuck to grilled chicken, fish, turkey. I even had grilled vegetables, oatmeal, lots of water. I ate about five times a day. I didn't even eat a lot of fruit, a little fruit. But those are the things I really stuck with, and it really got me in great shape. Now, depending on the metabolism of each person will determine, and Jerry can confirm that, will determine what kind of a diet they're going to be on. Not everyone can be on the same diet. Jerry can confirm that as well. I mean, I have a better metabolism, so I can tweak my diet a little bit more where I can add a little bit more fats, maybe a little more calories in what I'm eating, where another guy might not be able to take in the same amount of carbohydrates or fats or calories that I could take in due to the fact that their metabolism isn't working as fast. They may also have to do many more aerobics to lose a lot of the fat and burn the calories. Now, in my case, I couldn't do aerobics. If I did aerobics, I would totally lose all my muscle. So I was one of the guys who was lucky back in the day that I didn't have to do a lot of aerobics. And Jerry can attest that a lot of the guys back in the day did hours and hours of aerobics. But I don't think that's really necessary. So if you're watching a real tight diet, you really don't have to do tons and tons of aerobics. Those are for guys who I think probably don't want to diet hard enough, so they'll replace the aerobics without changing the diet too much. But for me, it was a pretty easy shot for me back in the day. But again,
okay,
I did have to diet at one point as I got older as well, and today I follow even a stricter diet.
Mm-hmm. You said prescriptive diet?
No, a stricter diet.
Oh, stricter.
Yeah, I stick mostly now to fish, chicken, turkey, vegetables, oatmeal, water, non-fat milk, whereas years ago I used to drink whole milk. I drink non-fat milk now. I eat whole wheat bread. I don't eat white bread anymore. I mean, there's a lot of things, like I said, I just cut back on. I stick to a lot of vegetables, oatmeal, whole grains, turkey, chicken, fish, lean ground beef. So those are the things I'm eating at this point in time.
Okay. Jerry, go back to when you were talking about anaerobic and aerobic. Can you give some examples on somebody that's in boxing or tennis or things that are, there's more anaerobic than there is aerobic? What specifics do you recommend?
Well, anaerobic sports basically are strength and power sports. In other words, they short bursts of intense activity. A sprinter, for example, is anaerobic. Now, let's look at track, for example. You have two classes. You have the sprinter. Now, you see a sprinter who's running 100 yards there. He's going full burst maximum. He's using his very high-intensity level for a short time. That's like pure anaerobic. Now, you compare that to, let's say, a marathon runner who has to pace himself or herself because they're running 26 miles, 385 yards. That is aerobic.
Right.
So, the type of diet that would be good for an anaerobic sprinter would not necessarily be very good for a long-distance runner. A long-distance runner, for example, would require a far higher carbohydrate intake, whereas the sprinter would be able to use certain supplements that I wouldn't recommend for a marathon runner. One example is the very popular supplement creatine. Creatine is fantastic for sprinters because it matches their energy usage. In other words, they're in a very high-intensity, what they call ATP-CP energy cycle, which utilizes creatine, whereas the long-distance runner, the marathon runner, they're going to have what they have to focus on is glycogen. They have to maximize the glycogen, which is stored carbohydrate. It's stored in the liver and the muscles. They have to store enough of their body to basically kind of last for 26 miles, which is, it takes a little bit of practice to learn how to do that. And they also have to know how to utilize fat, because unless they utilize fat, they're not going to make it to the end of the marathon. And these are those runners you see occasionally. If you watch marathon races, they call it hitting the wall. What happened is these runners have run out of glycogen. They haven't paced themselves properly, and they haven't done anything to utilize fat. So basically, it's like trying to run a car without any fuel. It just stops, and that's what happens to these runners. The muscles literally fail to function. So again, you have to take in. You have a sport like tennis. You mentioned tennis. Now, a lot of sports have a combination of aerobic and anaerobic. In the tennis, you know, you have that you're hitting the ball, you're moving, you know, you're using your muscles. There's an anaerobic component, but then you're running around to chase the ball and get it. There's your aerobic component. And basketball, for example, is also kind of a mix anaerobic aerobic. So in those instances,
right,
you have to include, you know, you have to basically, you know, hit both sides of the road. You have to give them foods and supplements that will increase their muscle power and also that will increase their endurance and maintain endurance for the length of the athletic activity. So, again, it depends
right.
on each individual sport. It depends on how long the event will last. Obviously, a marathon, you know, a good marathon, what, some the world marathon.
2.5 hours.
What, pardon me?
2.5, 3 hours.
Well, it's 2 hours for the world class guys, but you know the
right.
average guy who goes in a marathon, you know, four, five, even six hours they take to get to the finish line. You know, I mean, but the world class guys are just over about maybe 2.5. I think it's about a little over two hours, 2.5 hours, something like
right.
that.
Right. Yeah, you mentioned a creatine earlier in the conversation, and
right.
And I know creatine, I believe is, if I'm not mistaken, is a protein. Is that correct?
It's basically a protein byproduct, if you can call it. It's what they call an amino acid compound. It's made
okay.
from three amino acids, glycine, arginine, and methionine. And it's made in the liver, kidneys, and pancreas. The human body produces 1 gram a day. Everybody produces 1 gram a day. And if you eat foods that are high in creatine, such as meat, you get another gram. So it's about a two gram a day intake is usually correct for creatine.
Yeah. Can you comment real quickly, because I've read or I've heard that too much protein, the body or the kidneys cannot assimilate properly. How do you balance or weigh, how do you weigh the, quote, the amino acid supplements versus what your body can handle?
In other words, the question being, is protein dangerous for the kidneys? Is that what you want me to comment
well,
on?
Well, no, not the protein is dangerous, but maybe but too much, the excess of the supplement, you know, too many amino acids. How do you balance
right.
that out? Maybe Bill can comment on that too.
Okay.
After
right.
you're done.
That's a good question. That's a very good question because, see, there's a huge misconception about protein. I have a personal peeve. When I go on the Internet, I'm always reading these articles by registered dietitians and other so-called nutrition experts. Where they're warning people about the dangers of excess protein, and the statement that really gets me is, too much protein will make you fat. And what they're going by is biochemistry texts. If you follow the way protein is used in the body, and excess protein in the liver, it goes through a process where the amino acid portion, the amino group of the protein is cut off, and without going, again, into excessive technical
right.
details, protein can become glucose. Sugar, and
okay.
that's the kind of, you know,
okay.
and you know, of course, excess sugar theoretically can be, you know, diverted into a fat pathway. Now, here's the problem. The problem is, it's a possibility with very sedentary people that literally don't move, you know, the so-called couch potatoes, you know, if they take in an excess amount of protein, you know, and the protein is not being used to, let's say, rebuild muscle tissue or whatever, there's a possibility that if they're eating a huge amount of protein, then they could actually get some body fat off it. But here's the truth. Dozens and countless studies have shown in active people, excess protein is oxidized in the liver. In other words, it goes through that same breakdown process, but rather than actually being turned into fat, it's literally burned up. It's like a match. It just disappears. In other words, the
uh-huh.
nitrogen portion of the protein is excreted, and the rest of it is just oxidized. So it never becomes
uh-huh.
fat. That's just a complete misconception. And as far as the thing about the kidneys, that's based on research years ago, which this still holds true today. If you're in kidney failure, complete kidney failure, to the point where you're on dialysis, your kidneys, you know, are the thing that processes metabolic waste from protein in the form of urea. And, you know,
right.
any extra burden on a failing kidney is not good. So if you're in kidney failure, yes, you should decrease protein intake. And they took these studies of people that were in near kidney failure, and they extrapolated that to healthy people to say, well, protein is bad for the kidneys. It's never been shown. They've done studies of bodybuilders where these bodybuilders are taking as much as five times the recommended dosage of protein, and it shows no stress on the kidneys at all. What happens is, just like a muscle, the kidneys actually increase their filtering capacity to take care of the extra protein. And as you probably know, we can all actually live with one kidney. That's the whole basis of kidney transplants. You know, people give up a kidney to give to somebody who has a failing kidneys. You can live with one kidney, so the kidneys can actually handle the extra protein. So, you know, that stuff is a myth, and it kind of annoys me because it's still being said today, even though it's that stuff should have gone out years ago. It's all not really true, this stuff about the protein.
Yeah. Well, we have a few minutes left here. I did also wanted to touch it. Do you want to make a quick comment on that? Because I had one other question for Bill. Did you want to comment on what Bill, did you want to comment on what Jerry was talking about?
Listen, I used to sit with Jerry for hours and we talk about nutrition. He's so good with this. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I've learned from Jerry. And he's right on. I mean, he is so – and I try to tell people, listen, if people read the articles in the magazine with Jerry, I mean, he's so far ahead of the research. It's unbelievable. He tells you stuff, and he's told me stuff, and it's like, what is this? A year later now, they come out with it, but he's already had it out already and knew about it. So he's really on the cutting edge of – you know, learning about nutrition and teaching nutrition. So he's been a big help for me with the nutrition part.
Well, I'll definitely have to catch up more, Jerry. This is fascinating. I've talked to many people over the years, but you're right up there as far as nutrition. Well, we have a few minutes left, Bill. I wanted to ask you what it takes. I know you went on to the highest levels of bodybuilding. What does it take? Just maybe just do a quick summary, and what does it take to mentally, physically, spiritually, to move to that level?
That's very good, because it's hard to teach anybody. When I first started, like Jerry, I picked up weights at a real early age. At 9 years old, I picked up some weights, and I was too young. I did it again at 12. It's amazing. You're too young. So at 14, I really got into it. I was inspired because I was 4'9", 110 pounds in high school. I was beat up by everybody in the school, and my sisters even had to fight for me, and the big guy around the corner. That's how bad it was, and I was determined to do something about my body and my weight. I mean, I couldn't play football, and I loved it because I was too small, but I could run track because there was no real physical contact, and I couldn't really get hurt in it. But I read books like Norman Vincent Peale, The Power of Positive Thinking. You have to be very, very self-motivated for something like bodybuilding. I mean, you have to really take focus, you have to have a plan, and you have to be very consistent when you're doing this. I mean, you see a lot of guys saying, and Jerry's seen it a lot, in it before too, oh, I'm going to be a great bodybuilder, I want to be a great bodybuilder. Well, it's not that easy. They see the pictures in the magazine. That's the picture right there. I mean, you're getting inspiration, but that person you're looking at has really, really worked hard. He's done a lot of things. He's eating right. He's training properly. I trained like about three times a week, but I had a specific training program I was doing after a couple of years. It was a guy by the name of Randy Coyle who saw me in the gym training one day, and I was training, Tom, for 5 hours a day. Jerry, you remember those five-hour marathon workouts, right?
Yeah, I did it myself.
I couldn't gain weight, Tom, and all of a sudden this guy came up and said one day, listen, kid, he said, I've been watching you for a while in the gym. You're here for hours, and you're not going anywhere. Listen, I was hungry for information. I think Jerry was the same way. I mean, I would listen to anybody that would give me the proper information. Well, and because I really wanted to get where I wanted to go, I listened to this guy. I employed four exercises. When he told me that, I said, four exercises? How the heck am I ever going to build a body with four exercises not being in the gym for hours? This routine took me only about an hour. It was squats, dips, chins, and pullovers. That was literally the program. But, you know, I wasn't gaining any weight anyway. I wasn't getting any bigger, and I wasn't getting further towards my goal. I tried that program, and in about 5 months, I gained about 20 pounds. That was amazing. Mm-hmm. That gave me a great boost. But you've got to be determined. You've got to have a goal. You have to live bodybuilding, basically. You have to have that visualization as well. You have to see yourself in that position before you get there.
We have about a minute left, and can you just quickly give out your contact information? We'd love to continue this another time, and we'll talk about that off the air. Just give your contact information, Jerry and Bill, how they could reach you by website or whatever you want to say.
Sure.
Jerry, you can go. Jerry, tell us your information, Jerry, about your
All right. I, I have a e-book for somebody who wants to delve a little bit more deeply into sports nutrition and but maybe possibly want to put on some lean mass and lose body fat. It's called Natural Anabolics, and it's available at jerrybrainham.com. One word, jerrybrainham.com. I also have a blog which has like hundreds of various articles on there. And this blog, again, is for anybody to read. You don't have to be an athlete or a bodybuilder. I have a lot of health articles on there, and it's at the address of that is Applied Ergogenics, one word, appliedergogenics.blogspot.com. And, of course, I'm also in Iron Man magazine every month. I have two columns, which, again, I write on. One of them is called Anabolic Research, which covers various ways, it covers testosterone therapy for older men. It's a lot of interesting things I cover that really up-to-date stuff that, you won't really find it anywhere else. So those are about the best way to check out my stuff.
Okay. We appreciate it. We'll look forward to it. And, Bill, give out your website.
Well, they can check out my website. It's www.billgrant.net. It's about 40 pages, and there's a lot of good information there. I have a video, a training video that I sell as well. You can see a couple of clips from that video, and we have a lot of information on that site as well. Just go through the site. You can also email me if you're looking for any information, need some help. I'm a personal trainer as well. If you're looking for a personal trainer in the New York area, if you're listening in the New York area, I'm here at the Iron and Silk Fitness Center. If you want to contact me, you can contact me at bill@billgrant.net. That's bill@billgrant.net. The website again, www.billgrant.net. And it's full of information. And again, I have to say, Tom, thanks for having me and Jerry on the show. And
we'll definitely have to do it again. There's a lot to cover.
Yes, and we could do this in another thing. Jerry is an encyclopedia of nutrition. We can talk a lot about training a lot more the next time we come on. Training for the aging and just getting in shape in general.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. We'll talk to you very soon.
All right, Tom.
Thank you very much.
We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
And again, thank you. That was Bill Grant and Jerry, former Mr. America, and Jerry Brainham. And this is Tom, co-publisher of Healthy Referral newspaper, and Marcia Carnicelli Minor, also co-publisher. I'm substitute host today, and we'll see you next time on Mind, Your Body, and Spirit Radio. Thank you.